This edition of Section D was first broadcast on the 21st of May, 2013. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis.
Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Alad John, standing in for Hugo MacDonald. On this week's show, we ask, what design can do? The Section D team decamped to an event of the same name in Amsterdam to find out.
In the end, in the world we live in, is always designed. It's a cliche, but everything you touch or use is designed. So you cannot underestimate the role of designers, because they are everywhere.
You'll hear more from the director of the event, Richard van der Laken, in a moment. And between the talks, breakout sessions and rather dismal Dutch weather, we sit down with founder of Poke and design tech entrepreneur, Nicholas Roop, to get his top tips for the year ahead.
The greatest thing that designers can do is use the tools that they already have, the thing that they're already brilliant at, which is seducing people.
Plus, we'll ask the editors, publishers and all-round fantastic men, Jop van Bennekom and Gert Jonkers, how their magazines are the model for a marriage between design and journalism.
I think the world needs editors. In that sense, I hope it sets a benchmark for publishing and for actually very edited magazines.
And elsewhere in the show, I'll be asking Indian architect Rahul Mehrotra what the West can learn from Eastern architecture. That's all here on Section D with me, Alad John, on Monocle 24. As you heard there, Section D is in Amsterdam this week for the What Design Can Do event. It's a chance to reflect on the rude health of design across the spectrum. To kickstart our coverage of the design event, I headed into the streets of central Amsterdam to meet the director, Richard van der Laken. I've come to the unseasonably rainy climes of Holland to the What Design Can Do event in Amsterdam. It's a conference where esteemed designers and thinkers from the spheres of fashion, architecture, technology, publishing and many more talk up the power of and potential for change through design. Away from the gloomy weather that's forcing the tourists in Light's plane to huddle under umbrellas, and into the warmth of the Stadsalberg, that's the municipal theatre of the city, and venue for the event, and the feeling is one of optimism. The yellow banner, screaming what design can do, a bright contrast to the grey of the rain outside, seems both a beacon and a call to arms for the crowd gathered inside. I'm going to try and track down designer and director of What Design Can Do, Richard van der Laken, to find out what he had in mind when he first conceived the idea of the event.
I'm Alad.
Hi.
Richard?
Yes, I'm Richard.
Nice to meet you.
Hello.
Dutch design is a certain phenomenon that you can see that people know all over the world. The Netherlands is a well-developed country when it comes to design. And I'm a graphic designer myself, so I travel around being part of this Dutch design community. And what I always noticed when I was abroad, it is so very inspiring to meet people from abroad, this international community, and that you're not only meeting up with other graphic designers, but also with architects, eating designers, industrial designers, and so on. So I was a little bit surprised that in the Netherlands, although we are such a well-developed country when it comes to design, we did not have this condensed moment where the international design community is gathering, talking about issues that matter.
Obviously, this is a conference, an event with big important focuses. Someone who hasn't been to it before myself, you're dealing with ideas of social innovation, what design can do for publishing, what can it do for architecture, all these huge spheres. Is there a danger that you might be spreading yourself quite thinly by addressing such important and wide topics?
Yes, of course, there is the danger, so that's something to focus on, that this is not going to happen. On the other hand, I also want to reach a wider audience. That is difficult because the people who come to this event are mainly designers or design-related people. But I also think it's very important that we connect with governmental organizations, companies, the industry, and the audience at large, the user, the consumer of our products and services. So then I think it's important that you don't focus too much, because then it will be very highbrow and elitist. That's what I really want to avoid.
So looking at some of the guests you have this year, Rahul Malhotra, for instance, fantastic speaker, really interesting subject matter. How far do you cast your net when you're looking for talkers? What goes into the process of you thinking, let's get him and her and this team of people? Is it a fairly easy process, or over the year do you think these guys are doing stuff which really interests me?
Yeah, it's a difficult process, that first of all. It always looks so easy, but when I started together with a group of other designers, we initiated this event together with other Dutch designers. It's difficult because you have to the proposition is the name of the event, what design can do, the relevance of design, the impact of design, and within that proposition we want it to be multidisciplinary, and we want it to be very international. We are the privileged side of the world, and it's also very important to see what's happening on the other side of the globe. So for us, that's always a starting point. What's happening in India or China or South America? So that is the reason that we get people like Raul Malhotra, and we also get Pedro Reyes and Carla Fernandez from Mexico. And next to that, of course, the most important thing is their story. What do they have to tell? What can they bring? And that always must have some kind of relation, or it must give an answer to this question, what design can do.
So that question, what design can do, the sense here is that there's a very important difference between talking about what design can do and the practical aspect, and the, as you say, designers do, and they're thinkers who also put their thoughts into action. Is the sense of this conference that they should be used more effectively?
Yeah, of course, that's the core of the whole thing. First of all, I have to state that designers themselves, they cannot solve the problems in the world, and in a way nobody can. I mean, we all have to do it together. It sounds a little bit corny, but that's, of course, it's what it is all about. But I think that it is important also here in the Netherlands and in Western Europe and in other countries, is that we all see that in the end, in the world we live in, is always designed. It's a cliche, but everything you touch or use is designed. So you cannot underestimate the role of designers, because they are everywhere. They touched upon everything that we use. And but on the other hand, we should not place them on some kind of a statue, because again, it sounds like a cliche, but you have to do it together with the government, with companies, with the industry. And so it's really important that first they have to meet with designers. They have to see the mutual needs, and then do something. And what we hope to achieve with this event is that we create this awareness, and that also we bring people together.
Richard van der Laken, director of the What Design Can Do event, talking to me there. Now, as you may have heard at the start, this week's Section D attempts to find out what, indeed, design can do. Over the hour, we'll be hearing from those designers at the coalface of the industry. Be it architecture, fashion, publishing or technology, they've all been giving talks at the What Design Can Do event in Amsterdam, and we've managed to collar them to shed some light on the role of design in their fields. You've heard from the director of the event. Now let's hear from one of the more sought-after guests. Designer, brand consultant, social strategist, man about town, artist, Nicholas Roop is very well placed to give designers some pretty sound advice about how to consult, develop and think design at all levels. He founded the Antrim Collective in the 90s, went on to start Holger, Blumen and most recently Poke. From product design dealing with the raw, usually unsustainable impulses of the male consumer, Nicholas shared his industry top tips with our researcher, David Pleasant.
I trained as an artist. I went to art school, and I think the most valuable thing I took from that was understanding how to sort of level everything, how to deconstruct things, and how to sort of not revere and give things incredible status, to try and break things down and look at them for what they are, and that's why I do my work every day. But it's also the reason why I'm uncomfortable with the idea of disciplines, because they're sort of, you know, for me it's about sort of stories and the craft, the specifics by how you construct those things is a bit sort of secondary, really. So I think the sort of defining things by disciplines is just not, for me, not particularly useful. I understand for a lot of people it's very useful, because obviously it's the thing that informs the way they do things and why they do them, but yeah, it sort of sounds a bit pretentious, but that's what it is.
Going on to what you put on breakout session today, and it was very kind of participatory and people really got stuck in. Can you explain what were you trying to get people to do and think? Talk us through it practically.
The brief I gave everybody was really based on the talk that I gave, which was around the idea that the greatest thing that designers can do is use the tools that they already have, is use the thing that they're already brilliant at, which is seducing people. So everything really across all the disciplines, you know, what we're all in the business, we're all in support of the idea of, you know, of creating sort of desire around, you know, products, objects, services, whatever it might be, by the way that we organize and package and present and express, you know, brands and, you know, all of that stuff. So it seems very natural to me that if you're looking to try and change people's behavior, you would do what we would do anyway. But rather than sort of I think there's been lots of, you know, attention placed on the sort of lobbying communication side of it, less on actually solving things on a product level and a service level, and saying, well, how do we sort of sex up things that we know are sustainable, good practices versus the things that we know are not? How do we sort of dial up their appeal using all the tools that we have at our disposal? So that's what my presentation was about, and that's why I threw back to this workshop and said, well, okay, you know, you guys over there pick something within the transport area, you pick up something in architecture, you pick something in food, you pick something in product, and try and pick something that, you know, that we know is good, we know is worthy, we know, you know, if everybody did it, it would move things on and help the world, but currently sort of suffers an identity crisis. Nobody wants to do it, nobody wants to talk about the fact that they would do it, nobody would enjoy doing it. And how do you flip that on its head? How do you alter it and kind of reconstruct it so that it is something attractive and pleasurable and, you know, and something that you would want to associate yourself with? I mean, it sounds like a tall order, but people cracked it really, really quickly. I think when structured in the right way, actually it's a solvable problem.
Nicholas Roop of Poke and many other frontiers, talking to Section D researcher David Pleasant there. Lots more coming up, including the lessons Western designers can learn from the developing world and the innovation on show in Mexican fashion.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. And for those of you just joining us, you're listening to Section D with me, Alan John, here on Monocle 24, standing in for your regular presenter, Hugo MacDonald. How to deal with rapidly expanding and unruly metropolises while celebrating innovation and ingenuity in design is one of the challenges many an architect will face in India. Instead of the mantra that architects always know best, urbanist and founder of RMA Architects, Rahul Mehrotra, believes that there are times when design can take something of a back seat. As he explained to me in the backstage of the event, good design in India celebrates the kinetic cities it works in and allows the inhabitants to change their living areas.
My name is Rahul Mehrotra. I am an architect by training. I practice out of Mumbai and work in India, but I also divide my time and I teach at Harvard University at the Graduate School of Design, where I chair the Department of Urban Planning and Design.
Let's begin by discussing the title of your talk today. It's about grand adjustment. A grand adjustment of what?
I think a grand adjustment I've referred to in the context of the urban condition, because I think a lot of business as usual practice about imagining cities are grand visions, which lock us into scenarios that I believe don't become very fluid. And I think what I tried to show in my talk was that in places like Mumbai, which are an extreme form of urbanism, the temporal landscape is what makes the city survive, because the city can't keep up with its growth, and therefore it uses space intelligently, configuring it and reconfiguring it on a temporal scale. And I believe also from the perspective of sustainability, that's an important message. So for example, in America, they build $1 billion stadiums that they use 7 times a year, and it seems ridiculous. ridiculous, whereas in Mumbai, spaces get configured with cloth and bamboo to accommodate large weddings. To every problem, architecture is not the response. And I think in the Western paradigm, architecture is being used too liberally as the instrument to structure lives.
So you think there's a balance between reinventing buildings, reinventing the purposes of buildings, and the kind of innovative nature of architecture in, for example, in Mumbai where you work?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think static space is not the solution to everything. And one of the problems with using architecture as the only instrument to order our environments is that they actually create very strong and hard thresholds between different parts of society. For example, the glass stars that are landing everywhere, including in Holland and England and all over the world, are terribly not only brittle in terms of their form, but you are confronted with a reflecting glass star that tells you nothing about the life inside and actually excludes you from the public within. And that's an example of how architecture actually makes these thresholds between people in a city really severe. And that it's an acute form of privatization for the elite and the wealthy. And I think all cities are suffering from this.
Using an idea of reinvention, of maximizing the potential of buildings without that kind of static sort of basis. Do you think that's something which is more easily applied to Mumbai, for instance, or the developing world?
That's right. I think the application of what I call the deployment of temporal landscapes and therefore the notion of grand adjustment versus grand vision, I think is applicable everywhere. But I think what we have to also be mindful about is that in the global south, so to speak, I use that broadly, climate is often to an advantage because the climate allows people to do much more in the open, which means it makes the cities more elastic in the way that space gets used. And of course, culture plays a big role because in some cultures, memory is an enacted process, as I showed in my lecture. You know, people don't need to codify everything through architecture. And it's also a different belief culturally about the sense of time. In India, for example, they believe in the notion of cyclic time. They believe everything's going to be destroyed and reborn, and there's rebirth as an idea. Whereas in the West, they believe in linear time. And so histories are captured through architecture and extended so that you can extend time. So there are many differences, and I don't think it can be carried over as easily, and one must be mindful of it, but I think the temporal landscape has great power to be deployed in the West too.
How do you show that those ideals in your work? You talk about the difference between the extension of Western architecture and in the developing world, what you name the global South, the kind of the cyclical nature of time. How do you reflect those ideals in your work?
Well, in two ways. One has entered this understanding through a lot of work on historic preservation that I've done, which is when I first confronted these cultural differences. And, you know, in a post-colonial condition like India, it becomes even more acute because the creators and the custodians then of an environment are completely different cultures. So the kind of narratives you use in Britain to create emotions around preservation is where the creators and the custodians are one culture. And so in the preservation work, it became very acute to me. And so I began to extend those ideas in contemporary building in two ways. One is imagining life cycles of materials in different ways. That means don't lock something in for perpetuity. You make the bones of a building, but the flesh can change. And two is imagining all our buildings in ways they can be incrementally built. So like the buildings I showed you for the software company, they were modules that could be added over time or adapted for other things. Or in the building I showed you the whale, the inner spec building was one thing, but the expression on the outside was another thing, which weathers differently, changes, can be dismantled, reused, etc. So one tries to build in the scale of time as a mode of imagination in the deployment of those ideas.
You talked about a project which you were working on, and we saw some wonderful slides, some pictures of elephants and people, particular peoples in India. Can you kind of paint a picture for that project and the ideals that you're trying to represent with that?
Well, I think for me there were two or three conceptual kind of fundamentals that I wanted to deploy there. One was this whole idea that the landscape was critical to these beings and therefore how one could reverse it. And for the Public Works Department, landscape is not even in their specs because it's only buildings in their specs. So how one had to subvert the system to deploy that was, I think, a very important part of that project. The other was how one could, through design, subvert what were limitations imposed on poor people through legislation. So it is 40 square meter houses all lined up in a row. And so we reconfigured them as clusters to surreptitiously, in a way, add a small open to sky space and a courtyard to each community group. So they could actually expand their houses 10 times because they would use the courtyards for most of their activities. And so in a way, you empower poor people with space through design and configuring it like that. So as far as we were concerned, we built 40 square feet of space, but the space had a court attached to it, and then three houses had a bigger court attached to it. So this was an idea of how can one empower poorer people through design moves and design strategies.
You talked also about the arrogance of design, or the idea that as designers you think you're above the needs of the client to an extent.
Life takes over architecture, and after a point, especially in housing projects, you must let life corrode the architecture. In fact, you're making an armature for life to blossom. We often, as designers, want to make an armature for ourselves to blossom, our own egos to blossom, and therefore we have this fetish of control. I think in some projects it's a valid approach, which are projects which are public, which are about representation of society and all of that. But in housing, you must let life corrode the architecture.
Founder of RMA Architects and urbanist Rahul Mehrotra, talking to me there. This is Section D with me, Alad John, with this week's show, a Dutch design special from the centre of Amsterdam. Now, the study of design is no longer all about products, objects, and how things look. In some schools, especially in Holland it seems, you're just as likely to be conducting a social science experiment as you are trying out a new prototype to be put to market. The concept of designing without having anything tangible to show for it might seem strange to some. Hoping to make a little more sense of all the design theory being bandied about the conference, David Pleasant met Australian-born self-proclaimed design activist Ben Landau just after one of his crowded breakout sessions.
I used a project that I did last year, which was about a group of fictional objects looking at the futures in energy. And I wanted to basically look at how designers, instead of maybe designing objects in themselves, can map future social possibilities, not necessarily in the next few years or in the kind of distant future where there can be any kind of futuristic possibilities, but more the in-between where the difficulties of today intersect with the kind of random possibilities that could occur in the near 4 to 40 years.
And that was kind of centered around a museum, a collection of objects, which seems quite straightforward, but it's a really complex idea. I struggled a little bit with it. Can you try and kind of recap what you're trying to do with those objects that you presented in a kind of physical cabinet?
I use the idea of a museum because I think when you go into a museum, all of these objects have specific stories. And so I wanted to make a future museum which looks back on its past, which is our future. So yeah, it is a complex idea, but I think it also gives these objects a real sense of reality that they could be true. And in the objects themselves, I used to work in a museum, so I have a fascination with museums. And yeah, I think the objects that museums collect are often kind of boring. You go into the back of the museum and there's a necktie. You think, yeah, it's just a necktie. But then they say, yeah, this is the necktie that was worn when the Prime Minister was inaugurated, and then this happened and this happened. And behind the object, there are all of these stories. And we are designers creating objects, but maybe we don't always know the stories that will be attributed to them. So in creating a museum, looking into the future, I tried to have a look at what stories could be told in the future.
Which kind of leads quite nicely to my next question. We've just come out of a breakout session which you took part in, and it was kind of raised that, you know, maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, if we talked about sustainability in design, it would be centered around products and designing products and physical, kind of tangible results of the design process. But now it's very common, and you know, there's a growing trend of looking at designers and designers being almost social anthropologists. Do you recognize that in yourself and your own work?
Yes, definitely. The difference is, I guess, we are creating the objects which reflect on this anthropology. And I, in my work, I'm trying to also ask designers to realize maybe the little incursions that they're making on people's lives and the difference that that makes. So in my speech, I also said that by making this museum, I'm sort of like an active archaeologist or maybe anthropologist in looking in ways that people will live. And I think it's important for designers to realize the behaviors and the connections that they push or encourage people to do through the objects that they make, which, as you said, aren't always objects, but sometimes systems as well.
What's also quite interesting, just as an observation, is you're kind of early in your career, you're young, you're doing your master's program, but you've really taken center stage at this event and been given a lot of time and a lot of interest. People want to hear what you're saying and are really receptive to that. Do you feel like you're representing kind of the new generation or the current next generation of designers, steering away from that kind of focus on product and making things with your hands and so on? Do you feel like there's a trend towards that? I mean, you've described yourself as a design activist. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, I'm not sure I represent a generation, but I think that our generation definitely has new responsibilities. But it's easy to just end up dealing with those responsibilities in a very dry way of maybe just providing solutions. And I think that solutionist way of thinking drives us to sort of think within the possibilities, whereas I want to look past the immediate things that we can see and maybe look at longer term effects or trends that designers can have. And in terms of activism, I think that all design is political, that design is itself as a political act that forms people under a certain way of living or being. So I think in terms of activism, the message of the designers is really important.
There's been a lot of talk of localism and kind of looking at the context and where we are right now. What do you think is special about Holland? What brought you to this country? You know, is there something unique for creatives, for designers? Can you sum it up, like what it's like studying, meeting people here?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing is that everything is so close. I don't think I've ever met, in the 2 years that I've been here, so many incredible, inspiring people who really think in a very different way. I think in the Netherlands, and also, let's just say in the Netherlands, I feel like there is a lot more of a focus on society and philosophy in a much more sense of that it's part of everyday life or the community, that there are the philosophers who give talks in public. And I think that maybe that doesn't occur so much in Australia. So I think that there's a greater connection in Netherlands between the ethics and morals and people and the way they live their daily life. And I think the Netherlands has an amazing design history, but that's definitely changing. And you were talking about before whether I represent a new group of designers, but I think I don't represent them, or I think there's a new group of designers coming about through necessity, through changes in funding to design, definitely in changes to design education, and also the expectations of designers to be increasingly relevant, I guess, to others, not necessarily useful, but definitely relevant.
And finally, just to finish, what can you take home from this event? If there's one thing that kind of sticks in your memory, what have you learned? What have you learned that design can do?
Maybe design can't do as much as it says it can do. I look at the projects that people show and think this is just a really pretty pictures that people have taken of their social project in order to show at this conference. So I'm a bit cynical that design can do that much. I think maybe the biggest thing that I've taken from this is that this is a collection of designers talking to other designers. And I think the tools of design are available to so many more people now that it shouldn't just be about those people who can afford 300 euros to come to a conference. I'd much prefer to see the type of design that gets out on the streets and not talking to people that matter, but saying that if everyone is a designer, then they can all contribute and listen and be part of this discussion and not be such an exclusive thing. I think if design could do something now, I think it would become maybe less exclusive.
That was Ben Landau talking to our David Pleasant there. Still to come in part two, we'll take a peep at the studio behind the graphic design team, Manshaft, discuss ethical fashion with Mexican designer Carla Fernandez, and I'll sit down with Gerton Yop of Fantastic Man fame to explore their partnership of design and journalism.
I never liked journalism that is very much based on having to crawl on your knees into a interview room and be very thankful to be able to speak to somebody for 15 minutes.
All that to come and more here on Section D with me, Ala John, on Monocle 24. Now, situated in the heart of Amsterdam, in a small building attached to a medieval church, is the studio space of the two-man graphic design team at Manschaft. It isn't the most typical setting to meet a contemporary design partnership. As part of our regular peep into the working lives of designers across the world and the music that inspires them, we went to meet Manschaft's Andreas Schroffel and Rob Meermann at their studio.
My name is Rob Meermann. I'm a graphic designer, and you're in my office of my company called Manschaft.
I'm his business partner. My name is Andreas Schöffe. We are in the oldest part of the city, right in the center. And we are surrounded by the famous Red Light District, which is slowly changed into a more fashionable area. They want to upgrade it a little bit. And we find ourselves like a glued right alongside the old church, the oldest building of Amsterdam. And I always say we are actually in the intersection between flesh and spirit, let's say, because we have, on the one hand side, we can see the prostitutes, and on the other the side we sometimes can hear a church choir sing perform, and it's a very interesting environment.
So we think this our office was actually the house of the bell ringer of the old church, and you can see it's wonderful because it's sort of wrapped around the choir of the church. We have a tiny little kitchen here. It's a bit like a boat. If you walk around, you can hear the floorboards creak. And here's a bit of church bumping into our office. This must have been some sort of, we've made a little library here. The wet space, you can even have a shower here. And this is where we usually have meetings, but I think it was the former bedroom. We really love this office because it has 12 windows opening up to the water, to this canal, which is a very busy canal. It's on the eastern side, southeastern side, so it's very sunny. So we're always here. It's fully, we're bathing in sunlight, really. It's a very pleasant place to be. We usually start at 10. We work until, 7:30. And the fun thing is that you're inside, but you're always outside because there's so much to see outside because there's water. This canal is very, very busy because it leads onto the A, the big water outside Amsterdam. So there's tons of pleasure boats coming by with people, which is sometimes hard, having a good time on their boats, and we're working.
That's actually one of the best things, Being right in the heart of the city means that so many people drop by.
Everything's walking distance. Dam Square, Central Station, Newmarkt, the shopping area. So when friends are in the neighborhood, they give us a ring. Are you available? And then we meet up. So it, even if you have a busy period, there's always a way to break out for a moment without hassle. So, we like, for example, we like the wild beasts a lot. Well, it was very funny. Also, I got a tip when I was at an old studio when I was buying a bread at a bread shop. And the guy behind the counter, he told me, you really have to listen to the wild beasts. So he gave me the CD, and I'm putting it on the studio, and we got kind of addicted to it. And then we also went to the concert. So it's very funny how it can go. And when we are kind of confident about a project and it's going well, and then we put the music on.
Wild Beasts, The Devil's Crayon, from their first album Limbo Panto there, ending that insight into the studio of Manschaft. You're listening to Section D with me, Alan John, on Monocle 24. After this interlude, I'll sit down with the founders of Fantastic Man, Jop van Bennekom and Gert Jonkers.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
In a region typified by change, Istanbul is in the middle of a renaissance of its own. Monocle Films visits the historic city to witness its contemporary metamorphosis.
Battles over the projected identity of Turkey on the landmarks of the city translate into protest. While disagreement over the future exists, pride in the changes is not in short supply.
Istanbul Inspired, a film about change in an ever-changing city on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Section D with me, Ali John, standing in for Hugo MacDonald here on Monocle 24. Now, in an age where publishing can take the form of 140 characters, a post on a blog, or even the more old-fashioned form of actual print media, it's heartening to see that some magazines still stand out from the crowd for the time and care taken to put together a publication of real quality. Fantastic Man is one such magazine. From its launch in 2005, it continues to celebrate a partnership between good design and journalism, and distinguishes itself thanks to everything from the layout, the use of font colours, to the approach it takes with interviews. I caught up with editors and founders Jop van Bennekom and Gert Jonkers to find out how design plays a crucial role in the success of their media brand.
For us, it has been in the very beginning about, let's say, breaking down the barriers between editorial and design, and publishing, because we're also the owners of the magazines and the founders.
We really don't separate it. I think the way that we execute the magazines that we publish and make is that it comes together very gradually, very naturally, or very laboriously, you could say. But it's never a piece of text and a headline that is being sent to a designer to actually throw it on a page. I mean, that's not really the way we work.
Do you see your model as an idea that other magazines can take on board? The merging of design and good journalism, as well as the founding of these establishments?
Well, I think increasingly we've been made into an example how it could be successful, editorial design. You know, it's also something that's, let's say, fairly new, something of the last 10 years where editorial design actually really became a discipline in its own almost.
We really don't know how to do it differently. It's not that we designed a model to work.
No, exactly.
It's like this is the way we do it, and we don't know how to do it differently. So that's the way we do it, and is what we do. You know, the combination of a very editorial approach to design or a very design approach to editorial, is that a new model? Well, maybe. I mean, I think it works for us, but it really works for us because it works for us.
I just hope, because there's more publications where people from different disciplines got together creating a magazine. Take, for instance, Appartamento, which is a photographer and an editor, and then a visual language. And the style of the photography became kind of like very central to what the magazine actually is. So I think the world needs editors. I think the world needs people that actually choose and edit, you know. And that's something I'm always really missing online. In that sense, I hope it sets a benchmark for publishing and for actually very edited magazines that are content-driven and editorial-driven rather than only commercial-driven.
How important is it to establish a brand identity for you to be able to communicate with an audience and then to become a successful magazine?
I guess it is very important, but it's also not really a way we think. We just really aim to make a good magazine, and we want the magazine to be good. And God, I never thought about branding.
Also, we just don't think about Fantastic Man as a brand. I think it's a little bit too personal for that. I mean, we're very aware of the fact that we come out twice a year means that we, you know, we cannot really execute proper brand building because, you know, it's just only there twice a year, which I like, because I like the idea it's not always available, and it's not, the magazine is not omnipresent. It's something you have to sort of search for. You know, a lot of people are asking, why do you come out more often? It would be amazing. But I think there's something in the fact that you can't get it. And there's something rarefied about it, which creates also desire.
If I can touch on Gentlewoman as well for a moment. What are the issues that you face bringing out two different types of magazines? Do you see them as completely different spheres, broaching the female market, as it were?
No, if you talk about branding, that had a kind of a branding effect. Like, okay, the guys from Fantastic Man actually are, venturing into the women's market, which gave a huge boost to Fantastic Man. But yes, it's very different. Yeah, it's a very different market. I think men's magazines in itself are almost niche. You know, there's a certain kind of man that buys a magazine. Women's publishing is much more mainstream in itself. You know, women buy more magazines than men do. So yes, it's been a very different experience.
How important is it that you get behind the stories and you portray through the design and the photos as well as the writing that you are getting close to the people?
What we always ask of our subjects is basically a lot. You know, we don't want a photographer to turn up for 5 minutes and make a quick snapshot like how newspapers work. We always ask, you know, like at least half a day for the portraits done in the studio. We have budgets for proper photography. And the same goes for text, where we just always would like the subject to be interviewed a couple of times, be following around and have a very invested story.
Yeah, I think it's important to approach your subject in a sort of same level way. I mean, maybe that sounds arrogant, but I never like journalism that is very much based on having to crawl on your knees into a interview room and be very thankful to be able to speak to somebody for 15 minutes. I think it's much more interesting for it to be an investment from both sides. I mean, yes, we invest in an interview in the sense that we take the time to speak to somebody two or three times, and we're willing to travel. If somebody wants to speak to us in Athens one day and in New York the next day, we'll try to make it work. We don't have Vanity Fair budgets, but we try to make that work. And it's an investment from our side, and it's an investment from our writer and photographer at the same time. And I think it should be investment from the other side as well, because otherwise it's not going to turn out well.
What's the magic of design involved in the production of Fantastic Man and The Gentlewoman?
Well, I think the magic is of the design is that it's hardly there. It's a very formal language in both magazines of just typography and rule lines. It's very simple. It just puts photography next to text, and it has a headline, and it tries to create magic with just a few ingredients. What that magic is, I cannot read.
Well, I think the magic is that it's really good, but that's I can say that easier because I don't do the actual design.
Just finally then, what challenges remain for the two of you?
We function in a world of fashion. We're not purely a fashion magazine, but obviously we are interested in style, and that also is a fast world. And you know, the challenge for us, for me, is to remain as good as we are and to even be better. It's hard to get at the top and be recognized, but it's probably harder to stay there. So it's really important. There's not a second to rest and sit down. It's just like it has to be good. The next issue has to be amazing, and there's still a lot of work to do to make it amazing.
Gert Jonkers, a Fantastic Man, ending that interview there. You're listening to Section D with me, Ali John, on Monocle 24. Now, as the world's eyes fell on the recent tragic events in Bangladesh, the way in which we value and source our clothing is being scrutinised now more than ever. All the more refreshing, then, to come across a fashion designer who not only strives for decent pay and new opportunities for those who make her garments in the developing world, but has a passion for making beautiful clothes. Most importantly, she is also interested in making money and profits for her workers. Mexican fashion designer Carla Fernandez has wholeheartedly endeavoured to better the lot of some of the poorest of the womenfolk in her native country. David Pleasant caught up with Carla to find out more.
So since when I was very, very young, I was fascinated by the traditional garments, and I decided to go deeper and deeper. And I discovered in a design term, because obviously anthropologists and sociologists knew this, that Mexican traditional garments are mainly done by squares and rectangles. And for me, it was very interesting because we had a special way of doing clothing. And if you study fashion, you will see that, for example, Japan took the kimono or the shibori and made this amazing new revolution of fashion, or maybe England that took the punk and this, hard core, or in turn it in the spirit of the country into something that you can actually do business, and you can do creative businesses and creative alternatives.
Does it make good business? What has been your experience? in terms of scale and numbers. Tell us about that process and the difficulties maybe.
For me, the most important thing of our business is that we can live out of it, the artisans and the people that are involved in the workshop, myself. Because as you say, many times it's just an experiment of, okay, let's do a new design, and then suddenly you spend 1 year making that design and it doesn't have a commercial going out to the world. And it's really, we have to change that. I've been like fighting that instead of that being the purpose, the most important thing is the product, because the product has to sell. And why it has to sell? Because if we don't sell it, the artisans cannot continue being artisans, and I cannot continue being a designer. So that is like our major goal, and we're doing it. And that's why we also have these two lines, that one is called Ancestors, that actually has the craft part that is made by hand. But also we need to have a scale. We have to produce, and we have to, if someone needs 1.5 million jeans like the government of Oaxaca, we have to do them. And we also pay the artisan for the ideas, because as we know, crafts can be very difficult to make. And in Mexico especially, the ladies that work with us, they have really 8 kids, and they have a lot of things to do at home, and they have very few time to produce their fabrics and textiles. So there's no way that that fabric, that we feel that she made in 3 years is going to pay for that. No one is going to pay the 3 year work. So we have to start thinking of artisans as well as designers, because ideas are the ones that at the end of the day can give you the money to live. So, and obviously we have to be very careful of keeping the tradition, but also giving money for everything that is mass produced in a way, no? And I believe that also the people that we work and that they do these 1,500 jeans, these people that also needs work, and it's a chain. We have to develop that chain.
And business aside, tell us a bit about the items. They're beautiful. You had a wonderful presentation. You went through some of the collections. Describe some of that process of taking indigenous crafts and turning it into a fashion piece.
For example, the collection that we're now selling is spring-summer 2013, and we made it in the south of Mexico, that is very well known because they make hammocks, for example, and they make machine embroideries, but drawing it by hand. So we knew that there was all these problems with the hammocks, because China now it's making them by machine, and obviously it's very difficult if you don't know, and if you're like not aware of what a good hammock is, you see them the same. And obviously,
what is a good hammock?
Well, a good hammock, it's made by hand, and you can sleep beautifully in it, and the threads are amazing, and you can wash it. And especially it's in the size of the length of the fabric and how it's made. And we decided that to make part of the dresses as hammocks, and it's working very well. And also the fringes of the hammocks that they're made in Mexico are beautiful. So we decided to include also those fringes as accessorize and be part of the collection. So it's working very, very well. The ladies are very happy because it's fun. It's much easier than a hammock. They win more money. And well, we are like trying to be also creative with the problems, because obviously, well, the Chinese, they can do hammocks, and there is no way that they don't do it. No, it's also their business, and they have to take care of their people. So we take care of our people.
But you're making the most of Mexican traditions and celebrating them in a way.
Yes.
And finally, about the ladies who wear these items, what's kind of the reaction? What does your clientele tell you about the things that they get from your shops? What's been the reaction in Mexico?
We have clients from around the world. Basically, our clients buy our garments because they love the garment, not they love the story. I mean, but that is something that we have been caring a lot, that you buy it because you really are going to use it and you really like it and you feel amazing when wearing our clothing. And it's easy. I mean, in a way, I produce clothing that you can use every day or maybe for special occasion, but you can put sneakers and it can look like a designer clothing, but it's not extravagant. It's not something that you will point and say, it's like, oh no, you're gonna get it stuck somewhere, or it's too wide to get into the restaurant, no? So we, as we want to be a business, we take care also of the design that people can wear.
That was Mexican fashion designer Carla Fernandez talking to our researcher, David Pleasant there. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for in this week's special edition of Section D. You can contact me, the producer of the show, at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on Section D, or maybe just bend my ear if you've a burning desire to share an idea you've had. I'm Alan John, standing in for Hugo McDonald this week. Hugo will be back next week to step into the breach once more. And playing you out, it has to be something Dutch this week, doesn't it? This is Caro Emerald with Tangled Up. Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.